Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Joshua Yunkin. Today we're pleased to present the final part of a three-part series taken from a talk recently given by Dr. James LaFenue to a Seattle audience. Dr. LaFenue is a critically acclaimed science writer, a former medical practitioner, and author of The Rise and Fall of Modern Medicine, and 2009's Why Us? How Science Rediscovered the Mystery of Ourselves. In the previous segment, Dr. LaFenue explained that differences in biological form are not due to differences in DNA sequence, which is largely the same from one animal body plan to the next, but instead depend on more abstract layers of coded control that defy reduction. Similarly, simple acts of perception cannot be expressed in the descriptions hazarded by brain scientists, much less can the language of neuroscience capture what it is like to experience oneself, to know directly one's own thoughts and impressions. Even though the picture of our physical and mental selves grows more complex the more we look, the reductionist regime persists. Dr. LaFenue concludes his talk by suggesting why this might be so.
And certainly, there's no doubt that one could carry on doing these studies forever. I mean, theoretically, biologists could, if they so wished, sequence the genome of every single living species. And that would, but that would only confirm that each of them is made up of the same 20, 25,000 genes which code for or determine the proteins and the cell structures of living things. And the really important question, which is what distinguishes an elephant from an octopus or from you and me, would remain elusive. And the same applies to neuroscience. And one could do, if one wished, a million scans observing subjects watching a bouncing red ball. But that would not take you an iota further in understanding how it is that we perceive that ball as being red and round and bouncing. There is in all this, it seems to me, the strong impression that science has been, in a way, looking not so much in the wrong place, but seeking answers to questions that lie outside its domain. What it is that, as it were, can conjure from the monotonous genes strung out along the helix, the richness and diversity of the living world, what can conjure the richness of the human mind from the electrochemistry of the brain. And I think there are two reasons why one might think this is the case. And the first, obvious in retrospect, is that biology is billions of times more complex than the physics and chemistry of the material world. A fly is billions upon billions upon billions of times more complex than a pebble of comparable size sitting at the bottom of a pool. Not only is capable of things which lie beyond our understanding. How it is that it transforms the nutrients it consumes into its own flesh and blood, how it reproduces itself, how it perceives the world, and so on. And so though it is indeed an extraordinary thing that scientists can tell us how the origins of the universe, the moment of the Big Bang, and the formation of the solar system, and all that sort of thing, these, in a sense, is a trivial fact and compared to trying to explain what is the phenomenon and what are the laws which lie behind the fly. So that's the first. And the second reason why I think that one might think that science genuinely reached its limits in this is that on reflection, it is predicated obviously on the assumption that all the phenomena of the world, including ourselves and our minds, are reducible or explicable in strictly materialist terms. And that is, in a sense, a reasonable assumption, because, after all, the whole history of science in the last 200 years is predicated on the assumption that everything is ultimately explicable in materialist terms. But it is an assumption. And the interesting thing, it seems to me, about both this thing about the form and attributes of living things, as opposed to their materiality, why is an octopus different from an elephant? both that and the thoughts and imaginings of ourselves are by definition non-material. That is to say, they can't be weighed or measured or objectified. And so, strictly speaking, they fall outside the methodology of science to provide an explanation. So that then seems to me to be the paradox of the best and worst of times for science. As it is caught in the invidious situation of being crushed between, on the one hand, the extraordinary achievement of the ability to tell us the history of the universe from the moment it started, an achievement that can never be repeated, and confronting the deep inscrutabilities of biological form and biology and the human mind, which seem to lie beyond its powers of understanding. Now, not that this is going to change anything very much, because, as one can suppose, you know, the show will stay on the road, the funding will carry on being rolled out, and we will have, you know, hundreds more genome projects and neuroscientific studies and so on and so on. But there is a hazard in this. And what the hazard is this: there's a saying which is that under the banyan tree, nothing grows. And under the banyan tree of this big science that now dominates the scientific world, the really creative and genuine and innovative science gets throttled. The sort of science which seeks to explore anomalies, which is not content with conventional theory, and which seeks to develop science in new and interesting directions. And so, as a result, science threatening to implode under an avalanche of undigested and indigestible facts has become dogmatic and defensive. These, then, are very interesting times that we live through. And my concluding comments. It seems to me that science, the academy, mainstream orthodox science, has prided itself in the last 50, 100 years on having secured its boundaries against the incursions of religion and metaphysics. Only to discover that those perennial, profound metaphysical questions have re-erupted again in his backyard. And obviously, the theory of the Big Bang necessarily raises the question about the origin of matter. And the laws of the universe are so fine-tuned that one might think that they were fixed, necessarily raises the question about who did the fixing. And so it seems to me, with the most recent advances in genetics and neuroscience, in bringing to us attention the profundity of the mysteries of life and the mind, that, to paraphrase Hamlet, one might suggest that there's more in heaven and earth than can be dreamt of in your materialist philosophy. Thank you very much.
Although a reductionist approach to physics and chemistry have been largely successful, Dr. Lefanu points out that this is not the case in biology and neuroscience, as the subjects of those studies have proven far more complex than the mere objects of physical and chemical study. The program to reduce subject to object will march on, it seems, at least until the line between subject and object is fully recognized for what it is: real. This has been ID the Future. I'm Joshua Youngkin. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.